and thinking about this word that I have come to love, immeasurable, as I sit here in one of my favorite places on earth with a headset on my head and a phone to my ear and four good friends near, I think of what is measurable in order to play with feeling more deeply into what is immeasurable. So I think of how the things that we can see and taste and touch and hear are in so many ways measurable. So this day is measurable, and we do measure. We do count the number of hours of sunlight, of nighttime. We measure the temperature, and we say, oh, that was a high, or that was a low. But even in feeling into these specific measures of a day, I think it's easy to feel how the measurements don't block, don't stop the immeasurable from coming through. The heat on my back. Knowing how fast the wind is blowing doesn't necessarily stop the immeasurable from coming across in the touch of the breeze on my face. So often we do get caught up in the measuring and the measurements, and it does stop us from experiencing the immeasurable, but I think it's helpful to remember deeply, like really to come back together, remember in ourselves, to gather together, to gather ourselves, where we can really feel, be felt as immeasurable in this moment. Not to just know as one more concept that the immeasurable is available, no matter how many measurements we take, that our measure taking does not block the immeasurability of aliveness. So even a life, which we can feel sometimes how precious it is, even a life is measurable. It has a beginning and it has an end, eventually. Eventually, someone could look back and count the number of days that we lived. And there could be a kind of counting that savors the immeasurable in each day. And there could be a time that we tire of counting, and we let the immeasurable come across through our presence. I think we need to be aware of our love of measuring, of our tendency, I don't mean love in the deepest sense, of our tendency, of our attraction towards thinking that we know about things by knowing the numbers, thinking that we know about life because we know about it, because we think that we can compare this heat today to that heat yesterday or last year. So the measuring doesn't need to get in the way, doesn't need to get in our way as immeasurable beings. And so we could feel, what is it about our way of measuring and comparing that gets in the way in our experience? It doesn't actually block anything, but it blocks in our experience. It blocks us from sinking into the depth where we can't measure. We can't say this is deeper or less deep. It's that deep. And we only want to go deeper. But it's not that it's more deep that we go. We give in, we give ourselves wholly, entirely into depth. And we experience how in that depth, it's also height. It's also shallow. I'd like to play a short recording of just the wind before a summer storm here a couple of days ago. The friends who were here heard it that evening before the big storm. They're not hearing it right now because we didn't figure that out technologically yet. And what you're hearing is you're hearing a lot of the wind brushing against the microphone, and in the background you can hear the wind and the bamboo. And in the background you can hear the insects crying out. And so sometimes trying to find our way of feeling through our measurements and our comparing to the aliveness of what is happening. It would be like hearing through the friction on the microphone to the sound of the wind and the bamboo. But if we can feel where we measure from, then we can feel that we're already blocked before we start measuring. If we can feel where we start, where we want, and almost a panic, to know the temperature of the day or the forecast for tomorrow. And it may happen on a day that we didn't know the forecast and suddenly it rained. We got caught by surprise. And it was just wet. And it cooled off, and it was just cool. Sometimes not having the numbers helps us feel through the measuring mind, which we could say more clearly, more precisely, to feel our way through, to feel ourselves through the net or filter of fear of being out of control. Which includes fear of death. The storm that we had was a storm that could make you think of dying. As it went on through the night, people staying in tents. It was a strong storm. And imagine not knowing the storm was coming. And I remember one time being in the States and there was a storm coming. And I guess there was nothing else to put on the news because the storm was on the news. They were actually interviewing people about what they thought about the storm that was coming. So imagine, it's hard to imagine now, but imagine not knowing the storm is coming and it comes, and it's a strong one. And it just being wet, and it just being cold in summertime, and it being loud, it being bright for seconds at a time. And it bringing us closer to a living sense of death, where we can feel, what if death is not a punishment or a mistake or a failure of any kind? What does that tell us about this life? That we're all living. If we're listening to this, we're living. Or we wish we were living it more fully. What does that chance of being friendly with death? What does that chance of being friendly with death help us know now, not about life, but in life? In those moments, sometimes we know a different kind of love. A different kind of love from what we're used to dealing in. And it's curious how I would bet that each one of us who is here listening just now, anywhere on the planet, morning in the United States, afternoon in Europe, evening in India, nighttime in Australia, for example. I would bet that every single one of us who are somehow brought together here by this crazy technology, blog, talk, radio. Thank you, blog, talk, radio. We have each experienced a love that can be called immeasurable. But then in our dealings with each other, in our dealings with life, trying to deal with life, we kind of deal down to the kind of love that people seem to talk about all the time, which isn't love. It has expectation in it. It's almost entirely made of expectation, really. That love, that other one that's not really love, that's measurable. It has expectation so that we can measure it. Did you fulfill my expectation? Then that's love. That's that kind of love. When we deal down. It's really, you can call it attachment, you can call it expectation. You can call it slavery. But what if we stopped calling it love? Maybe that would leave us more space for that other experience that we could call love. Or we could leave it nameless and remember that it's immeasurable. That there, it always seems to have room for more. When we hear each other and ourselves talking about love in a way that's measurable, that becomes the reference point. We allow that to be the reference point. And it's so hard to let go of the reference point and stay with our experience, especially because the experience has nothing in it to hold on to. It refuses to be made into a reference point, a new one, to replace the old one with. And it's true that at a certain point we do need to make some kind of plans, and the children need some kind of stability, and we do need to make some kind of living. We need to eat something. The practical does need to come in. But can we kind of come in with the immeasurable slowly enough for ourselves, not to deal down? Or slowly enough that we feel what's happening when we deal down. We can feel what we're abandoning and for what. What kind of a bad trade it is. So that at least we know which kind of love are we talking about here. And which kind do we want to live? It's so easy to call an experience compassion when what it really is pity. What it really is looking down on and getting distance from something that we hope would never happen to anyone, including especially ourselves or people that we so-called love. People that we depend on, rely on, expect from. If we know pity as pity, it's not as much of a problem. But when we pretend that it's compassion, then it becomes easy to forget our real experience of compassion, not being separate from something that used to seem to be other. And so one of my favorite phrases from Indian spirituality, especially Kabir, using that phrase, not two, not one. And this is one way in to immeasurable love, compassion, joy, steadiness in aliveness. Not two, so not me helping you, poor thing. Not two, so not me helping me, poor thing. And not one, so that I cannot ignore what is different. And where life would come rushing through to meet itself. Where it would come rushing through to be met, to meet. To be tender at not two, not one. When there's two, we can measure. When there's one, we can also measure. When there's not two and not one, there's no interest in measuring. There's no interest in measuring how much time am I devoting to you? How much time are you devoting to me? It's a meeting. We can call it a meeting. We could call it an edge. Or we could find another word that doesn't imply two and one. A space, a spaciousness. A space that's so full of spaciousness that there's always room for more spaciousness in it. In that spaciousness space, what happens, what comes along, lasts a lifetime and perhaps beyond. Those moments of meeting, those moments where we let go of the perceived safety of two and the perceived safety of one. And we let it be as it is. If we can just keep track, as if it's like a pet dog in us that keeps wanting to go and smell the measurable. We're going on a walk and it keeps going after the smells. If we can know that, and sometimes maybe we just, of course, we let it smell what it wants to smell. That tells me something about this place. About who's been here. About who's not here. But maybe we don't need to stop and roll in it. So in the four Brahmaviharas of the Buddhist tradition, there's love and compassion. Vihara can be called a resting place. Vihara is also the name of it that's given to places of deep practice, so a monastery. A place to stop working. A place to come to rest, and that's vihara. And Brahma is this space that's so full of spaciousness, it can't stop itself from giving itself all over. All over, all over. It can't stop itself from letting that giving happen. It doesn't believe in fear and not enough. So the third Brahmavihara is joy. And how many times have we confused joy and excitement? How many times did we get excited about our joy? But the times that we were able to bear the joy, so we were able to absorb it so deeply in, as if into our womb, and bear the joy as it filled this space of spaciousness. Of expansiveness. Those times hold more than those seconds could hold. The immeasurable comes through the measurable. And this is what our lives, we could say, our lives are for. Accepting this measurable venue and not accepting that what's really happening is about measurability. And not getting tied up in the illogicalness of it. In a moment, something beyond time happens, comes through, and never ends. Even though the moment ends, the experience ends, the expression that brought immeasurability into our world in a tangible way, in a tangible moment, in a countable moment. Not blocking ourselves with that mind puzzle. Not stopping ourselves with the excuse that the immeasurable has nothing to do with time or space. It's just an excuse. It's something in us that's crazy about limitation. About pretense, about hiding, about trying to do what others seem to be doing, trying to get along. That place that deals down, that takes pity for compassion, that calls attachment or expectation love, that calls excitement joy. It's not that it blocks the potential that is here. But it does seem to block our experience of it. And somehow that seems to be important. Not just to live with the hypothetical love. Not just to live with hypothetical compassion and pretending, faking it until we someday, maybe we might make it. We don't need to make it, it's already plentifully available. And the fourth Brahmavihara has this, as Brian Tucker, my friend, would say, very unsexy word, equanimity. People who know Brian are chuckling. Steadiness. What we tend to trade in for real steadiness, for real unstoppability, is an imposed neutrality or even dullness, numbness. Because this fourth Brahmavihara is so out of this world, it's so unexpected that steadiness could be that alive, could be that fun, could be that much of an art. That steadiness could be that continually changing like a fire. I'm just checking in case anyone's calling. Feel free to call in. We have a few minutes left. 4.5 minutes. Even if you just want to say hi and tell us where you are. We told you where we are. So we certainly know, we might not always realize when we're imposing neutrality, trying to be that spiritual look that's not bothered by anything. You know that game? Trying to be that spiritual game that's not joyful and passionate about anything. So that game. But we also do know there have been the moments that it was like surfing. There was the steadiness that wasn't trying to make everything else stay the same so that I can hold this together. And it wasn't trying to make my inner world stay the same so that I could pretend to be equanimous. It's something that wells up. It comes like a spring of water coming up and spreads out. So it's fluid, a fluid, unstoppable steadiness. And it's especially important in this opening up and waking up to immeasurable aliveness. Because I think generally what happens is we're doing our best and sometimes we are quite open and then something startles us, something scares us, something surprises us, and we freak out. And we try to go for the fake equanimity, where we try to make ourselves not be freaking out. Or we completely lose it. Instead of trying to feel that everything that's going on and could ever go on, we can surf. Partly because death is not a punishment. Partly because failure happens to everyone sometimes. It's allowed. And so why not try that lovely surfing game again? Even with this and even with this. Does anyone here have any question or comment? No need to be shy. Yes? No. Okay, she's going to ask me the question and I'm going to tell you what it is. But we have 1.5 minutes, so we'll be...
When you speak about equanimity, we have so much experience, and I cannot say... For something, yes, I have for myself some equanimity when you are speaking about death. But some, for other things, I suppose I am not in this place.
Yeah.
Because it is, I have not experienced other things.
So Anandiji is saying that sometimes she can see equanimity happening in certain situations, but there are other situations where she can see clearly there is not equanimity. So in our last minute...
This
is her response to the topic of equanimity. Yes. Yes. So I think it's a very good question. Part of it we can say is there are going to be situations where we do freak out. And if we cannot freak out about our freaking out, if we can take the signals of freaking out as a chance to let life come rushing in to some kind of openness rather than a rush to try to make it be normal again. So again, the not being afraid of being a failure in that moment, so-called, and being seen to be wobbling, to being seen as not steady. I think this is very important. So that then it starts to, it's kind of practicing openness even when I'm wobbly. So as we listen to the birds of Dharmaloka again, like we did last time for the ending, we allow ourselves to be wobbly where we are wobbly. We bring in as much love as we can there, rather than punishing ourselves for the wobbliness or defending ourselves for the wobbliness. So not being right, but being alive, so that the wobbliness itself is an expression of immeasurable aliveness. No problem. And that acceptance and peace that comes in allows everything to be as it is, not my responsibility to improve, and yet full chance to respond fully to everything in this limited world. When I feel I have to do it all, I won't do anything. When I feel I can respond from the immeasurable place, not from the place of fear and controlling and trying to improve. I trust, I have confidence in aliveness of how it keeps being enough. It keeps overflowing with more spaciousness, more love, more true compassion, joy, which is your name, and steadiness. That deep stillness that is like a silver liquid that allows the others to take care of our business. So we can keep talking here for 13 more minutes. We're not on the live show anymore. If anyone has another question, it will be in the podcast that people can listen to later. So if anyone wants to say anything else, if there's more here to go into. I think not to be surprised that there, if we cannot be caught by surprise, that sometimes there's not equanimity. I think that helps. Sometimes just the very fact that I'm getting off balance is what makes me start to look at myself from a split place. So now I'm two or three. I'm watching myself or I'm watching them watch me. And then it's very hard to get back to the spaciousness.
My question was very, very specific.
Yeah.
One experience.
Okay, so let's go into it, if you like. So she said she has a very, it's not a general question. She said there's very specific,
there's
specific areas where she loses equanimity.
Once I remember, they say it cannot be. The people have no fear of death. It's not.
She's saying it cannot be that the people have no fear of death.
And I don't agree with this because mm-hmm. you can. I was in a hospice for 1 year, and I see so wonderful things. And also for myself, I say, sick my 5 years in India, because it was the main question. And I see this place for this moment. I went to Laughlin, I say when my first year I was looking at Kali, and it was, you know, the tongue outside, mm-hmm. like it was laughing at me. And after 5 years, I say, I am looking at her now. something happened on this place. But it's my only.
So Anandiji is referring to the images of the goddess Kali, who is usually black with messy hair and skulls with her tongue sticking out, and she's not afraid of death. And after going back to her home country and working in a hospice, knowing people who were dying, she felt she could look back at Kali, this image of not being afraid of death, and laugh at Kali.
So for this place, something very, very quiet for myself. But I cannot, very simple situation, another situation, I am not in this place. My reaction can be very strong also. Yeah. And so it's not a place I can say, we can be all the time. Yeah. We'll be so, for some one question, for other question, is not the same.
Yeah. And Anandiji is trying to throw the phone away because we're using the phone as the microphone. The telephone is the microphone.
Yes.
Today.
It's really what I have my experience.
So that she's saying this is her experience.
Little things, not important.
Something very small that seems unimportant.
And I can.
And she can lose it.
I lose everything.
She loses. She's throwing her hands up and saying she loses everything. Even knowing it's not important. This is a great point, because many times in an emergency situation, we can feel much more easily into the qualities that we're talking about as a way to talk about immeasurable life.
Yes.
Life that goes beyond death. And in the everyday annoyances, frustrations, frictions with other people, and with ourselves, is when we are more likely to try to go for control, judgment, shame, blame, fear of the unknown. So partly just knowing that is very helpful. And what I feel sincerely is when we know that death is possible, we're more willing to go, we could say to go to mommy, to go to the immeasurable in our conscious lived experience. And when we're in the everyday, partly because we're used to living the everyday as a way to be numb. Do you know this word?
No.
It means not feeling, not sensitive.
Okay.
As a way to feel in control. It's not always the case. And also many times it is what needs to be done. Many of us will need a kind of certain rhythm that's very helpful for us. But still, we could be in rhythm without being in control. This is an art to find. So partly because the way we usually use everyday life, we use it as an excuse to be less sensitive so that we can relax and feel so-called at home, in quotation marks. And we use it to try to feel control, to not feel the unknown. That's part of it. And partly because the main point I want to make is that, just checking the time again, the main point I want to make is that we don't sincerely care enough about our own lives. Unless our experience, our outer experience, is reminding us of it, of how precious each moment is. And so I'm not pointing this at you. I'm saying generally we can see this, we see this. But if we can experience a little bit more, a few more times we allow our experience to be immeasurable, not to be packaged in measurements, comparing, competing. If we can be more strict parents, let's say, inside, that we do not allow competing, because competing is untrue. Competing is a lie. Competing collides with being true to oneself, with true aliveness living through us. But it's so tempting, and everybody's doing it, and then we deal down. So another way to put the same thing is that the practical stuff of the day has its importance. And for many people, and especially people in a spiritual path, it can be that we don't even quite recognize its importance. It's the treasure of it, the true treasure of just the food, the walking on the earth, the water, the bathing. We are still learning the treasure of that. Or in trying to learn it, we try to impose that from the outside or copy what someone else does to honor that. And so our dealings with the practical take on the center of the stage or the center of the mandala, of worried about what time, how much, will they like it when I'm making a meal. So again, it's very tricky because for many people, including many, especially people on the spiritual path, there can be that kind of spaciness, avoiding, ignoring these important details, not knowing their value. And so, it doesn't matter, we're just going with the flow, it doesn't matter if lunch is late. So that's not your case, but I'm just saying. That can be there, and still, if we find a way that we can be in accordance with time what needs to be in accordance with time, when that's possible, when that is in the flow, which is much of the time, if not early, on time. If not on time, early, nearly always, and once in a while late. This is what I see happening when there's flow. But when we really feel how powerful each gesture, each morsel of food, each gaze of the eyes, each touch of the earth, when we really feel how powerful that is, it can be overwhelming. And so then we go, we could say in this case, if I'm talking about touching the earth, we deal up, but we deal down, we go for what everyone else is doing. That it should be like this, and then we feel safe. Well, in my house we do it like this. This is how you do green beans. This is how you do pasta. This is one of the great things about cooking together, is to know that what I prefer and what I think is how it's done is just what I have lived so far. It's not right. So if we can feel that how, instead of staying with how powerful it all is, immeasurably, we let our sensitivity meet and be met with the sensitivity of all things. It simplifies, the situation is simplified. It becomes very clear what's important, what needs to be done now, what needs to not be done now, what needs to be said now, what needs not to be said ever, probably. Yeah. But it's very, we let it be powerful, and it's the situations simplify in our experience. The priority is more obvious. And the practical side is more efficient without our having to be bustling around. Usually, sometimes we do have to bustle. But. So in the last around 1.5 minutes, does anyone else? Do you want to follow through, or does anyone want to say something? Say your name first.
My name is Lorna. I wanted to ask, how useful is it in these experiences of, like, maybe losing track, or, like, that sense of what's really important, to bring back the notion of death, and like the reality of death, and really, like, because in my experience sometimes when I do bring that in and I really feel like, yeah, I'm gonna die, then the things I'm talking about or the things I'm worrying about don't matter that much.
Thank you, Lauren. My opinion is that when that comes by itself, that can be helpful, but I would prefer a practice that is honoring and gravitating and practicing a gravitation towards the subtle. So when we come with the idea of death, it's like another strong shock to make me wake up, like, poof, slap, death. What are you talking about? Oh, right, what's important? Okay, one word is enough, and this is the word. It can be helpful when it comes kind of organically. But I wouldn't so much suggest it, at least not generally, as a practice. Being around people who are dying is different, like doing that on purpose. That's different than making myself think about it. Because being around people who are dying, the joy also can come through. The whole picture, not just the suffering and the physical pain and the loss, the emotional loss, psychological fear, etc. But the whole package, the whole aliveness. That's the end of that show. It would be practicing listening for and listening to and in the more subtle voice when we can access that. And when we can't, okay, I'm going to die any time. So what am I doing with my life? That's as a more of a last resort.
It seems to help me quite often, though.
Yeah, like, but if you can try to, meanwhile, like, you can, like, keep doing that. But meanwhile, just also practice stopping in other ways, stopping and feeling what's excitement and what's joy. excitement is sometimes here and sometimes not, and this potential for joy is always, it might not be available, but it's always potential. There's the potential for that expanding for no reason, absorptive quality. And if we just could stay there a few minutes, it may be 5 minutes, you know? Like often what we do is we don't give it quite enough time. We'll try for a few seconds and we say, oh, that I could, that's, yeah, but I can't. And then we try another technique or we give up and we just go back to the conversation that we were having. But if we could stay there for a few minutes, let's say five. It's like with Jinshin, you know, all you have to do is hold your, if you're afraid, hold your index finger. But hold it for 20 minutes. And it's so, because I didn't have to pay anything for it, I didn't have to go anywhere special, I didn't have to, you know, take a taxi anywhere or get an airplane anywhere. I just have to hold my nose. It's so easy to stop doing it, to forget after 30 seconds. But if I do it, it works. And so the main point of the whole talk, which I probably didn't actually say, is this, like, knowing our tendency towards the rough and the hard and the heavy and the easy to feel, if we can let our practice be going for the subtle, going towards the subtle, going into the subtle, letting the subtle come through, letting the subtle be our space. And what happens there is then when the subtle decides our space, our atmosphere, then naturally there's more fully giving in to that. But when it's rough, we only can give at most half, usually much less than that. We pay attention, okay, because we have to, because we're being forced to. But we're keeping back as much as we can. We're, like we were saying, fighting. We're fighting ourselves. And if we can notice how heavy and hard that is, and let that be a signal that I'm in the realm of the gross, let's say, the easy to feel, easy to be reminded by, easy to get caught up in. And if I can let go of my fear of the unknown a bit and fall, slip, sink into, spread into what's also here but harder to hear. It's also here but harder to access, harder to notice. Harder to notice, really, is all. And if I can let myself notice that for just enough time, that then that becomes the reality. That becomes my reality. My experience reality comes in tune with what is real, or closer to it. And that, again, then things simplify, priority is clear. So if it's difficult with someone, instead of, like, I could die and I wouldn't want this to be my last moment where I'm angry at someone for something stupid. That would be one way. Come on. But another way would be if I can manage to, if I practice also enough that it could be accessible in the moment of sinking, slipping, absorbing, spreading into, the more subtle, then I'm more aware of they're more subtle. And I'm also really aware, even if they're staying in whatever they were in, totally different kind of. So where I would normally need to have patience, like, and try to make myself not say anything, and it's not even really patience anymore. Things start to be like, it looks like courage, it looks like patience, but it doesn't feel like that inside. It just feels like doing what needs to be done, and not doing what needs not to be done.
The subtlety, does it have like a resonance in the body, like where you feel like on a physical level?
Yeah.
Just like really, I don't know even what it is, just much more physically, like really, I don't know what to call it.
Call it one thing, just say a word.
Like, well, it was the resonance.
Yeah.
That was,
yeah.
But
That's good. It's a good word.
Vibration.
Well, but it's there could be vibration when I'm angry.
No.
So it's a subtle vibration that's more in tune with what's real. And I think so. It's also that not fighting. When there's less fighting, at least I'm giving myself, so to speak, more fully into aliveness. So the body is happy that it doesn't have to fight. And so the body feels whole. There's more of a sense of wholeness in the whole body. And there also would often be a particular place in the body that would also, over time, change. It would move around, usually. And sometimes would come with brightness or color or image or word. That would also go with that overall resonance, attunement. Yeah. And that's already in itself what I was trying to say with Anandi. It's already in itself starting to appreciate the, even though this body is limited and measurable, it doesn't mean that it's also not immeasurable. And that resonance is an experience of immeasurable, let's say, expressing in body to the preciousness of something as simple as body. In our experience, it feels good. It's subtle, but it feels good.
I just wanted to say that for me it seems like to connect to the body on a really subtle level where I'm feeling that is like the starting point.
Yeah.
It feels like
that's
good. Where I have to go first.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, like the openness or the spaciousness can come.
Yeah. Good. Perfect. And so that's another good example of where there is the attraction towards the heavy and easy to feel, but there's also another kind of pull towards the subtle. So if I can consciously allow myself to be with the subtle, that subtle resonance in the body, I let that happen. I let it kind of take over, or let it be. And then that allows then to go towards the more subtle, so the sense of spaciousness. And then that can go to, again, more subtle.
So, like, is there, there's, because it's immeasurable, there's no limit on, like, how far it can, like, go into spaciousness?
The spaciousness wouldn't have a limit, and also what's really cool is, as we start to go, it's two things. It's like how we can't, we don't have a way with our minds of saying how wide it is. And as we give into that and let that be our experience, we wouldn't even want to try to measure it. And that's when we're free of the competing. We're free of saying, oh, this is a high, even with myself, oh, this is a higher state than last time, or with someone else. Oh, this, that doesn't even, it has no way to enter into the picture. And so in two ways we lose measurement. We lose the wish to compare and compete, mm-hmm. and we lose, we accept that what we measure with can't go there. We can't measure, we measure with thinking and concepts, and that can't go where we go. We can go, but that can't. Okay, and sometimes in order to kind of communicate, we can be here and use those words, those numbers, those colors, those temperatures, etc., to describe. And sometimes it gets in the way, and sometimes it doesn't get in the way. Sometimes it gets in the way because if I say, oh, this, I had this experience and it was like this, and
but
I put
it's happened.
Then that, it makes it again seem that the experience was that limited thing.
Yeah.
And that it was about that limited, that temperature, that color. When that, it was that that color, that temperature was, let's say, about something else.
But I don't know, but something from this experience. I take I learn something from this experience. And this learning, it is with me. I cannot come back to the same experience because I am not also the same person. But because when it was happening, they say me, oh, it's an experience. You know,
yeah.
Put it, it's not exactly. And I did understand because.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have feelings that I learned something from this place for myself.
Yeah.
I didn't want to keep the experience because you cannot.
Yeah.
You cannot, only running after something is lost. But something is happen and you can keep or you can do know what. It's some place.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. This is the kind of thing so that can happen where because we know in spiritual circles that it's easy to get attached to experience. So then there comes this statement, don't be attached, it's just an experience. And that becomes the answer to any experience.
Yes, it was a receive. Forget
about it. It was just an experience.
Forget. It was an experience.
Instead of being in that subtle resonance where Anandiji is expressing something that includes talking about sensation she felt at a certain time. And I don't have to make that be the experience that we need to reject and go to that recording out of fear that something might go wrong, like attachment, mm-hmm. or something might go wrong, like I didn't have the right answer. Or it sounds like it's a very knowing statement. Don't be attached to your experience. So it's an easy way to feel powerful to say that also. Mm. And it's an easy way to feel disempowered. Oh, I was getting attached to my experience. Wasn't important? Wait. And what we really also know in that lovely, subtle resonance in the body, for example, and how good it feels, there's a good feeling that stays. Mm-hmm. Because what happened wasn't limited to the experience.
Yeah. I learned also so much on my
and body. Yes. Yeah. And also, true, and also, not only that, but I did learn these specific things about that helped me in these specific situations, too. And all of that is an expression of this deep generosity of aliveness.
Jaya, how can you live from, like one experience that really, awakens you? How can you live just from, a memory of that?
You can't live from a memory. Well, that
and
wouldn't be living.
Keep saying
yeah.
I know that it's, this is the way, this is the truth, but then, it's like.
But where's, to me that's not living, so then I'm curious, where this question comes from. Do you see yourself doing that? Do you see someone doing that?
Yeah, I do. At times, not consistently, but I see that I'm reminding myself of things I've learned in the past.
Oh, okay. Right.
And not necessarily something I'm experiencing right now.
Right.
But I'm if I'm thinking or feeling something or something's going on and I know that's not really but then I'm telling myself no, it's not this way, it's not this way, it's this way, and it's I know I'm using an experience from the past.
It's like the death reminder. It could be helpful, but it has a danger to it.
Mm.
Because also you by using a memory repeatedly as a stimulus, then it's easy to lose track of really what the memory was of.
Yeah.
But it could be helpful in a certain time, especially if it comes organically. Like that's where if we trust our experience, we know it. If it's needed, it can come. So if my practice is staying open and receptive, then a memory of something relevant, a past experience that's relevant to now, can come.
Mm-hmm.
and inform me and help me soften in or feel the, you know, be more empowered or whatever is needed. But the danger, it would be like you would start to get a callus, both on the memory and on what you're using the memory on. Like, come on, be in the non-dual. Be in the
but I'm glad you said what you said about the not just like dismissing it as, oh, it's just an experience, because that's kind of how I was feeling also.
Right.
That, oh, that's how it should be.
Yeah. What it means, that's just an experience. What it means is that the specific sensations that I felt, so for example, where I feel and how I feel that resonance in the body and where I feel it more and where I feel it less, and what kind of imagery that might have triggered in my mind and what kind of emotion might have come along and what triggered the whole experience. So all of those things that we can measure about the experience is not something we can copy or try to recreate. And that all of that stuff doesn't mean anything. But what it transmitted, what was in all of that, is better than meaning. So the specific sensation of joy rising and then the image that I had of the Ganga in Varanasi or the sea or at sunrise or whatever, and the music that started, whatever it was. And maybe even the specific insights that could have come falling like rain out of that is specific to that happening, as you called it. There, it's all measurable things that I could talk about. Whatever I can talk about it is not, is true, is not important. But what was transmitted through that is important and is lasting.
My reaction now, when something happening to me, I know you.
I know you. If something happens, some that kind of experience comes.
Like, sorry, because
she said, "Oh, I know you."
I know you.
Oh, right. Oh, you again.
Yeah.
It's, it, I know, I'm laughing, you know.
Yeah.
Smiling.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Some meeting, some nice meeting.
Yeah.
Nice meeting.
Helpful meeting, but I don't need to keep that person tied to me forever from now on.
No, because I want
it's
a time.
It's what's in that
It was a
meeting.
Time I didn't want.
Yeah.
I was fighting against this.
Who, you?
Fighting, I didn't want. So I've lost totally my... when you lost your... I don't know the word. Well, my body, again, my body is speaking alone. I cannot do anything against it. I was fighting again so much.
You were fighting against losing control, or?
I lost my control in my body.
Yeah.
Was against this control.
I
was so much, I didn't want this.
Yeah.
For some fight. And so let's slowly do the choice.
I don't know why I feel like bringing up at this moment an answer to the question in the first interview of why are you here? And the first thing that came to my mind was, I've come here to die.
Wow.
And I didn't say that to Karsten, because it seemed like that might be a little...
People aren't doing that.
You're in good company.
But I also feel like I don't want to, like there are a lot of ways you could think that, like, oh, I'm going to be reborn, or come here to, you know, like, none of, it's just something I've just kind of been holding very lightly since then, and every now and then I'll wonder about it, you know, like how quickly that came up, and but somehow it feels relevant to this conversation. I have no idea why, or if it is.
Yeah.
I just felt like saying it.
Yeah.
Know, because it's the moment when it's being said.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just that a good moment example of something comes clearly, and it's so clearly like people aren't saying this kind of thing, so I better stay quiet.
Right.
And both, like, that's fine. Like, it could come and it's for you. It doesn't need to be said. And the exercise is to bring that up for you. It's not. And also, like, what if you said that?
Right.
And then Carson, what would happen for him? Would he be disoriented, but then also feel free to say anything?
Yeah.
And anyone who overheard you, whoa, they could feel intimidated, like, oh my gosh, she came, what? I didn't come here to die. I came here to live. There could be, so it's not that there's a right thing that you should have done it.
Yeah.
But we can feel for fun, what if you had, and if that gave permission to yourself, like you said it and you didn't die, and to others. So just that moment of something comes so clearly and we hesitate. It's not that we should then make a new should that we always have to say everything, because it's not, obviously that's not the case. But feeling, okay, in the atmosphere in the room, it would have made a difference of who knows how many different kinds, 7 different kinds, 8 different kinds. But also for yourself, what kind of space, kind of a brightness, that it came and you said it. Like, if we just use it as an example, that not that you should have, but
right.
What if?
That's
giving fully and not fighting.
Right.
And letting the subtle voice have enough space.
Yeah, it felt like the subtle
heard.
Voice.
It was
the subtle voice for sure.
Yeah.
And
so again, clearly, like, it's not that we always have to voice the subtle voice out loud, but sometimes, so often we hesitate and don't.
Right.
And what happens? What we could just playfully imagine, what could it be like if I had said that, or if you said it now.
Right, and it's just like, it just makes me kind of wonder and think about, like, the moment, what's that called, there's a French expression for this, which I can't come up with right now, but where it's just the right moment, how that, what's the chemistry of it?
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter, I'm trying to measure.
Yeah.
I guess by asking.
Well, but still bringing out the importance of, in your experience, that sometimes there is a kind of happening, a coming together, where it just feels like this is the right moment to say.
Yeah.
And so, for example, maybe this is the right moment to say what you didn't say.
Yeah. Right.
And you said it.
Yeah, and to have remembered it and held it, like... well, it reminds me of playing bubbles with Danny, and, you know, those bubbles. And sometimes they land on the leaf and they don't pop right away.
Yeah.
And you really want to, like, then you start to feel like, oh, I want to preserve this thing.
Right.
It was going to pop, but it didn't.
Yeah.
Of course it didn't. Yes.
Yeah.
One reason I like so much the chanting of Matak. Matakali Matadug. The two times.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's become very some friends with me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also to feel those not only as forces in life, but to feel that empowerment in our own life of Durga, who's the unconquerable. Never dying. Durga means fortress, which is like fortaleza.
Mm-hmm.
So untouchable, unshakable. And then Kali, which is related to the word time. Also, it's beautiful.
Oh.
Crazy kind
like
of
Kalpa?
No, but Kala.
Oh, Kala.
Yeah. Kala is a time.
And has no problem with killing, with ending, with...
But she's also nourishing.
With touching.
Uh-huh. But she's also nourishing.
Yeah.
Norwegian?
Nourishing.
Nourishing.
Oh.
No, it's something so fullness in this.
Yeah,
in this
she has story. No problem with
yes.
with death, sex, food,
yes.
intimacy,
mm.
power in this power more outward expression, more visible, more touching. So there's the untouchable, and then there's the touch everything, squish it.
And something Google something to look me at, or please not try, but give me the power to be in this place.
Yeah.
Riding on the,
yeah,
on the tiger, yeah, not what, something, I'm feeling the two persons, something one.
Yeah.
For myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, we can see also with the four Brahma Viharas, the steadiness, the equanimity. Giving the chance for all of the, for loving, compassion, joy, like this, that the power of feeling our untouchability, unshakability, then also allows us to have, like, the Kali's knife, the clear no, the clear end, the clear. Sometimes it can, we feel like to say, I came here to die, to say things that come from the subtle voice. The voice is so subtle, but what it says sometimes is like, whoosh, so short and clear and on the spot that we hesitate to say it because this is not said in private, I mean, in what, public or in polite company. This is. But if we remember that there are people like us that are longing to hear that voice, then it can encourage us to feel more finely and clearly if now is the moment that it comes out of the mouth and not just for our inner. But that, it's so that the unshakability helps us to shake, to be shakers, not to be afraid to shake.
I have a question that's very close, because what I meet also with a full acceptance. And it also sometimes can be also a feeling of sadness. And a feeling arises. And they say to me, so it's not right. You are not in the right place. If something happening to you, it's because you are not totally accepting what happened.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's right.
Good.
I don't know.
Good.
You don't know. You remember the net, you remember this, so you are not totally. Mm. I remember what Ramesh said something. And I did agree with you.
Yeah. Good.
A lot of things I did agree with you.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a wise person.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
A lot of... don't know what.
Yeah.
But I was not. I think this was... Because it, because we're in a body, we're human beings. So
yeah.
Italism is not... It's happened. Yeah. But you can see it's clear what happened.
I was lucky when I was having a strong experience of being pulled inside and a lot of stillness and some strange sensations, and also the mind changed quality, but there was still thinking. There was still thought. It was not busy thought, but there was sometimes thinking. And when it's curious also speaking about, like, not hesitating to speak and not hesitating to meet, because I'll just give you a little bit more context. It was on Bodh Gaya retreats, I think the second time I did it. And I always was afraid in the interview group, so I usually would not go to them. But by that time, I knew Christopher a little bit better. I was a yogi. Yeah. The second time I did it, participated as a yogi, as a retreatant, in the Bodh Gaya retreat. And by that time, I knew Christopher a bit more, and I was also working with being intimidated by his authority. So I asked for interview just for that, only for that reason, because I was afraid of him. And in the interview, I mentioned that I was also afraid in the group interviews. And he said, okay, so go to one every day. Usually it was every other day, so he said, go to one every day. Mm. And so I did. And it was in the extra interview group, the first time I went to one that I wasn't really assigned to, that it was, I already felt more free, and I was supposed to say something, and this was certainly in my experience, but I would never have said it in a regular interview. I would never have brought this up. Even though this was basically my deep meditative experience, I would not have spoken about it in an interview group.
But you were in an interview group.
I was in an
interview group.
Just
not your interview
group. And I went to the interview group once, my interview group once or twice. I think by that time I was going to them, but then I still said I got nervous for the interview groups. Christopher challenged me. So I went to the extra interview group in between the days of my assigned group.
In the bardo.
Yes. So already it was like, well, I've done what you're supposed to do. I've gone to the group. I've said what I'm supposed to say. And so I was already more free to say what was really going on. Like, from another perspective, it's really bizarre that I wouldn't have said what I said in that group, either in the private interview with Christopher or in the regular interview group, because it was something that's outside of what we talk about in polite company. It wasn't anything gross or perverse, or it was just that I felt stillness would take over. I wasn't totally sure what was happening. I felt like I couldn't move. I felt that my arms were behind my body, basically. And that would happen sometimes. And it was not unpleasant. And there would be some thoughts sometimes. And so I said this to Sharda, who was the one leading that group. And I remember when I got to the part, I could see, I remember, now I can look back at what I came through my eyes. So the people listening to me say this. So one particular man, I don't know what his name is, but I remember him watching me say this and listening to me and kind of probably being a little impressed until I said, and thinking is there. And then he was like that dismissal. But luckily Sharda said, and I think maybe she didn't really know what my experience was either, but she didn't dismiss it. She said, yes, this happens. This is one thing that happens. It's something with the elements. And if you want to know more about it, you could look up the elements, something like that. But basically, I don't remember her answer being so helpful, except that she didn't dismiss it. Mm. She didn't say, oh, well, if there's thinking, it's not deep. Because it was deep. And it was deep going deeper. It was my way in. So it's good to have what I wanted to say is like when there's access to the real love, compassion and joy with the steadiness, so then from the steadiness with access to all of those immeasurable spaces of spaciousness, there is that knife that can cut off what's dead. But it doesn't want to cut off what's alive. And it wants to be very caring in cutting off what's dead. Because what's dead is hurting what's alive. It's not able to be part of, it's not participating in the aliveness by coming to the ground and becoming earth. It's not just, sometimes we feel it's so powerful. I think we fear that we would just kind of get power, what's the word, drunk on the power? And, you know, just start using the knife, which can happen. It's not then that knife. It's not then the subtle voice anymore. But when we feel how precise the subtle voice can be, and on the other hand, how sometimes the words that the subtle voice comes with can be so like, that's such a used word, or what is that? You know, we don't, like, oh, there's so much love. And it's like, but when the subtle voice is coming with that in that moment, it may be what needs to be said in those words. And I don't like the words, who cares? I'm cutting off what's dead in me that thinks that I know what words need to be said and what are allowed to say and what's not allowed to say. So either we feel the precision and the sharpness and how it could shock someone or hurt their feelings or just be weird, or we feel how it's so imprecise, like love, peace, compassion. It's so used and
sweet.
It sounds too sweet. Yeah. Someone had an experience of golden light, and she had a thing inside herself that was very anti-New Age, and so she like anti-anything about golden light. But then she had an experience of golden light, and it was so true and good, but she was embarrassed to talk about it, even to me as a teacher of the meditation retreat. So we're shy to be that precise, sharp, and cutting, because the way we know cutting in the world is violent. And we're shy to be that embarrassingly sweet and light. And if we can just play with trust, and whether it's to use it inside, to let it be and have it space inside as what carries me in the day for a few days and then something else comes, or if I let it be also outside in words, not knowing what's going to happen, not demanding any results, that Carson has an enlightenment experience when I say that, he thinks I'm his true guru or whatever, but just simply, I don't know why, but I say it, and on time. So this is very much related to this about the immeasurable, in the measurable, having the timing, like daring to say it. And sometimes it's in that moment that it's the time to say it. And sometimes we it's for us, it's for us, it's for us, and then it's obviously the time to say it out loud here. Yeah. So. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's fine. It's funny.